You're listening to Swimming World Radio. I'm your host, Brent Rutemeller, and today we have the second part of a series of interviews with the author of The History of Olympic Swimming, Coach Peter Dallin. Thanks for joining us today again, Peter.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, for those who didn't listen to the first edition, we're covering his book. It's a series of books, which could possibly be a series of six, of which this is volume one, covering the period of 1896 to 1936. Coach Peter Dallin is an International Swimming Hall of Fame coach. He's also the author here, published by United States Swimming. Peter, let's just get right into this second part of this.
Okay.
The first part we talked about going all the way up to World War One, and in World War One, the games were suspended. What was the atmosphere like in 1920 when the games were reemerging?
Well, I think for the serious swimming countries, it was a feeling of great relief, and now we can really get going again. The Germans were put out for two games, and that really, I think, was too much. They didn't compete in 20 or 24, and that really put them behind.
Well, in 1920, the games are at Antwerp, Belgium, and judging by the photos, which are excellent in here, it looks like it was not a conventional pool, but it almost looks like it was a canal. Can you talk about that?
Well, I went to Antwerp myself for other reasons, but I was there, and I got somebody to take me out, show me what he thought the course was, but it really didn't look like anything. There's nothing that looks like a pool that is still standing. So the picture you have in front of you is as near as we can get. I mean, that's way better than anything that is still in existence. It was part of the harbor, and it was very cold. There's a little bit of an argument as to how fresh it was, in between fresh and salt. I suspect that it's brackish, which means, you know, part salt.
Yes.
Fresh.
And a lot of, just going on.
It was very tough on the hot weather countries. I mean, the Hawaiians, really brutal on them.
Well, speaking of Hawaiians, once again, the Duke was there. Could you mention a little bit about his performance?
Yeah, the Duke had the greatest meet of his life, or his Olympic life, I should say, because he went to three games. And he cut it in the big one. He really did the job and proved to the world that he was the greatest short-distance swimmer in the world. He swam on our 800 relay, so he had to have a good 200 to be even be on it. And then he won the 100. It was a drawn-out affair because they had to run, instead of just running heats, semis, and finals, there was a foul or a question on the final, and so they re-swam it. And some people, including the Duke, didn't do as well as they did in the regular final.
Now, he was 30 years old at the time. Is that correct?
He was 30 years old, and he was probably, like all Hawaiians, freezing to death in that cold Belgian water.
What other things stand out in your mind about those games in 1920?
Well, there was a great backstroker, who Kealoha, who came along, and he won the backstroke comfortably. And then he won it again in 24, before retiring. There was a breaststroker, who was the regular breaststroker of the Illinois Athletic Club, and that was America's first breaststroke win. This guy was a good swimmer, and we won the 800 relay by a huge margin, making up for losing to the Anzacs in 12. That was the combination of the one New Zealander and three Australians.
Mm-hmm.
The Australians were Empire armies. So they were in it from 14 on. They had 4 years of war, and we had about 1.5. That made a big difference. And some of our better swimmers never saw active duty. And the Australians got worked to death by the on the cry of Empire.
You know, what's interesting here is that they also, it was this the second time that the women were competing in the Olympics? And we, you know, there was two events, I guess it was, the women's 100 freestyle.
Three this time.
Three at the end.
It went from 2 in 12 to 3 in 20.
But
the third event was 400 free. Actually, 300.
Well, that's what I want to talk about, because earlier we talked about standardization in the previous interview that
right.
you and I talked about. Now, all of a sudden, we throw in a 300-meter. Was there some concern about women not being able to go the distance? Is that part of the
there was concern in all Olympic sports about women. And they just thought these fragile deers, it's too much for them. And what they didn't understand, that medically, women are better at distance than men.
Well, let me take the time to ask your personal opinion about the fact that there's still not a 1,500-meter swim in the Olympic Games for women.
Well, U.S. would love to have it, but we're a little bit nervous because if that goes in, then the proponents of the 50s of stroke would make another push to get the 50s in, and we don't want that because it's not really swimming. I mean, it's not that we couldn't do well, it's we just think it's wrong for the sport. And we think the 1500 is a much better event for women than the 800.
Well, it's certainly something that will follow as it moves forward. But coming from 1920, which I consider one of my favorite games personally, is 1924 in Paris, France, because the king of swimming up until Mark Spitz basically showcased his skills. What stands out in your mind then in 1924?
Well, in 24, Weissmiller won the 100 and won the 400. And that was considered a great feat. He was also on the relay, so he got a 200 on the winning relay as the anchor.
Now, you say Weissmiller like it just rolls off your tongue there, Johnny Weissmiller. But, you know, it's funny how people are losing touch with, you know, his more famed name, which is Tarzan. And you got to watch his career. Please?
What?
I said, you got to watch his career, either, you know, not firsthand, but you knew Johnny Weissmiller.
I lived through it. Well, Hollywood became a big deal in the 30s, and he became part of it as Tarzan, and leaping and from branch to branch, and being part of the apes, and having that special life. With all the financial benefits that went with it. He was one of the first great Olympic athletes to turn pro and really make something out of it. There were others who turned pro, but they didn't get that kind of payoff. He was a handsome man, and he was the best short-distance swimmer in the world. And in the Nationals of 27 in Honolulu, he also won the 1, the 2, the 4, and the 800 meters in the national. That was the national championships. And that's a pretty good string of 4 freestyle events. These were all either in world record or just missed the world record speed. I mean, it was really exceptional. That was his greatest meet ever. And that's why when he didn't swim the 4 again in 28, after swimming the fastest time in the world that year, everybody said, well, what the heck's the story? Maybe they're just saving him for the films.
Well, 3 gold medals.
Actually, what it really was, I think, the order of events, his coach felt that if he swam the 4, he would either be putting the 800 relay or his 100 in jeopardy. And that's what I understand was their real thinking on it.
And what I was going to say is, three gold medals was considered just absolutely amazing at that time.
He had three gold medals, and in the last games, we had a guy who had eight in one meet. I mean, when you look at that, why, three gold medals is nothing.
Yes, but at the time, it was considered incredible.
And Mark Spitz did have seven, because I was right there and saw it.
Speaking, going back to the 1924, if Johnny Weissmuller were to have swum the 1500 meter swim, do you think the gentleman from Australia, who was it, Andrew Charlton, do you think he would have given him a run? Or I mean,
I think either Charlton or Arne Borg from Sweden. In fact, I feel confident that both of them would have beaten Weissmuller. I think the 15 is a lot different from an 8, and Olympic Games and all your other events in jeopardy, I think it would have been out of the question. I don't think he could have done it.
What was
the program wasn't set for it.
Where were the number of countries in 1924? Do you know the number, and how was it growing on a global scale?
Well, it was growing steadily, slowly but steadily, and most of the countries that really amounted to anything, the developed countries were the ones who were swimming. There were almost no backward countries swimming at all, and it was Europe, U.S., Japan. That's pretty much. Australia, of course. That's pretty much who was swimming.
And then on the women's side, if you can go this elaborate on the women's side, because now all of a sudden we've entered in the breaststroke events, so the number of events is expanding for the women in the Olympics in 1924.
Well, see, in 20, we won all three events. We totally dominated. I mean, it was a domination that the men never experienced. It was unbelievable. Then in 24, the British still kept fighting hard, and they won one event, the breaststroke, and they had a whole bunch of seconds and thirds. Not as many as we had, but they were competing. They were the number two country in swimming. And then when we got to 28, countries like Denmark, Germany, Australia, started coming in more of a mix, and it wasn't just a demonstration by USA with the Brits still getting a lot of medals.
So let's talk about 1928. 1928, it's the Amsterdam Olympics in the Netherlands. It's a 50-meter outdoor pool, obviously. It's standardized at this time, but it's a freshwater pool. Can you describe the venue for our listeners?
Well, the Dutch came into the picture. That's what really happened in 28. And they had a famous coach called Ma Brown. And I'm going to get a picture of her, I hope, in the next volume, because she was one of the great coaches, women coaches of the world. And she had a lot to do with the Dutch doing well, even though they had a small population. But she really got after those girls, and she was the type when nobody talked back to her. And her daughter was one of the best swimmers on the team at the time. In the men, you had Arne Borg, Boy Charlton, and Johnny as the big names, and Buster Crabbe started in, and he got a third in the 1500. And there were others who were coming along. The Japanese, by this time, were winning medals. They won the breaststroke, and they had two other medals in two other events, and we still were asleep to what was going to happen in 32 in Los Angeles. And that is where Japan, of the six men's events, they won five in our pool, in our country.
And what?
That was a total shock.
Speaking of that pool, it's, you know, I'm looking at a picture of it right now, Coach, and it's in a stadium setting. It's a 50-meter pool in Los Angeles. That must have been absolutely impressive for someone to walk in and see that kind of competition.
That absolutely was and still is. It's a great setup. And right there next to the Coliseum, and a very extensive area for the media, which they'd never had before. And they had everything. And the results were sizzling. They really were great. The Japanese loved it. It was the greatest it was their dream come true. In U.S. on top of it. They won 5 and we won 1. The rest of the world won 0.
Now, when you talk about the media at the time, where is the swimming competition and compared to all the other sports as far as growing in you know, fan support and publicity? Where was swimming when compared to all the other sports in 1932?
Well, I think swimming was pretty good in 32 because we had the great facility. We had an extensive press area at the end of the pool farthest from the football stadium. And we had a warm-up pool, which was odd-shaped, but it was about 30 meters long, so they could really get some warming up. If you know that setup, when you walk around the pool, you are below the water level. And the media got a lot of shots from just looking over the edges. And I think it was probably the best media situation swimming ever had up to that point. And the American girls had a great meet led by that great gal from Seattle.
And that girl being...
And that girl being... Helene Madison. Curiously, she died early. She didn't live. I think she died before she was 50, even. But she was just great. And there was a little Dutch girl, a 13-year-old, who got second in the 100 free. And that was something that just shocked everybody because they didn't believe a young kid like that could do it. And she did, but unfortunately, by the time the 36 games rolled around, there was another Dutch girl who was better. And so Billy Den Ouden, was never Olympic champion. She got second when she was just a 13-year-old, but when she was a 17-year-old, she couldn't score. Even though she was better at swimming. That was sort of a little tragedy for her.
Well, as we...
And of course, 36 for U.S. is Adolf Kiefer.
Well, that's what I want to go to right now.
Adolf Kiefer and Jack Medica were our two winners. And Jack Medica had been a non-scorer in the 32 games, in the 400 and the 15, and in the 36 games, he got second in one, and first in the other.
Well, let's before we get too far ahead, let's bring our listeners up to date. We're talking 1936. It's in Berlin, Germany. Obviously, there's tension in the world once again.
Yep.
Adolf Hitler is at the event, and there's a lot going on undertones with far as, you know, Germany. Is this their second game back into the games? Because they were out in, what, 1920 and 1924? So they were in...
And they were in 28 and 32.
Okay, so this is their third game. What was just the general feeling and atmosphere going into this game before we talk about the specifics of the athletes?
Well, the general feeling was Japan was going to be dominant again. Germany was going to have a good team, and they did. I mean, if you look at the improvement for them over 28 and 32, they really did improve a lot. And they had a solid program, and then there was the pressure from the Nazi Party for Germans to excel.
And
they didn't win a swimming event, but you felt the pressure from their second place relay, from their breaststrokers. They had three good breaststrokers, and one of them got second. They were in the picture in a lot of events.
So let's go back to
not a big scoring team.
Let's go back to Adolf Kiefer.
All right, Adolf Kiefer.
And Adolf being was he 17 years of age at the time?
He started in 35 with high school swimming in Chicago, and his times were incredible. They were mostly 20-yard courses, so they couldn't be world records, but people could see this guy is going to have a shot to win the backstroke in the Olympics. Not only had a shot, he won it by a big margin over another American who was a Princeton freshman, Albert Vandeweghe, whose daughter swam very well in probably, I guess it was in about the 60s or the 70s.
And when you look at Adolf Kiefer now, I mean, he's been very successful, as an entrepreneur. After the games in 1936, he went on to be a part of the United States Naval Forces, teaching survival methods.
And he kept competing. He had a long string. He only lost one backstroke race in the 10 years after the games, and that was to a Michigan swimmer. It was a short course race, 150 yards. But Kiefer, he won every other backstroke race for that 9 or 10 year period. He was amazing.
Well, I think a lot of our listeners can read more about this. This is Brent Rudemiller. I'm with Peter Dalen. We're talking about the very first issue, or the very first volume, that Peter Dalen has written on the history of Olympic swimming. This is a second of two interviews where we've covered 1896 to 1936. It's been great talking about this. This book can be purchased at swimmingworldmagazine.com. It can be purchased through United States Swimming also. And, Coach, would you like to continue talking about a little bit about the next book, or how do you want to what can we share with our listeners about what's expected down the road here?
The next book covers the rest of the 30s, because we had a European Championships in 38, which were very interesting, and this is where the Danish girls came over the horizon. And in the men, the Germans were solid. The French were a good team. The British had some good swimmers. And U.S. Didn't have much international swimming at all until we got to the next games in 1948. So we missed two Olympics, and that had a very heavy effect on the morale of the swimmers, number one, and on the situation. Because when we finished the war, the Japanese and Americans had the two best teams, but the Japanese were kicked out of the games for starting World War II, or for their part of it. And so they ran their nationals on the same week we had the Olympics in London, and it turned out they would have won two or possibly three events of the six men's events. As it was, we won all six.
So a lot of the information will come out in the next volume, Volume 2, beginning with the 1938, I guess you're going to start off with, the European Championships.
No, I will, no, because the, they will, it will start with about 43 or 4, the build-up for the 58
okay.
game
okay.
in London.
Very good.
Where we're going again next time.
Which is right around the corner. And hopefully that next book will be out right around the corner. Until then, I want to thank you, Coach, for joining us today. And this is Brent Rudemiller with Swimming World Radio. Thanks again, Coach Dallin.
Thank you, Brent.